Gabois.
I'm Peter Myers.
And it's been a minute.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
It's been a, I think it's been a busy time for both of us. I know I just finished busy season in tax accounting for the spring. So it just kind of, you know, as one of the expressions, ate my lunch or whatever for a little while. So I just, finally we're able to record again, I think.
Yeah, no, it's, you've been really busy with tax season, which I'm sure you're happy is done.
Yeah, thank goodness. I cannot be working insane hours for a little while, so.
Yeah, like I remember the last time we recorded, you were up till like, what, 2 a.m.?
Yeah, that's right. That was literally the night before. That's right. I forgot about that.
So remember I was sick that day?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I went home and I did not eat almost the entire weekend after that.
Oof.
Like.
Oh my gosh.
I was miserable. Like, so have you gone back and listened to that episode, the beginning?
Yeah, no,
we
I
sound
did.
Dead at the beginning.
No, we're I like, know, because I was like, yeah, hi. Like, I literally just gotten out of bed, like, a little bit before you got there and was drinking my coffee and stuff, so I was still probably half asleep.
It was like, good morning, this is Of Mountains and Men. I'm Reese.
Yeah, I'm Peter. Yeah. And,
how's everyone doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, we're a little bit more energetic. I'm coming to the end of my busy season. I have one more week left with my athletics job. I was at work till 8. I'm a teacher, so mm-hmm. I teach during the day, and then I work for the athletic department. Albeit, it's a pretty simple job that I have for the athletic department, but it is longer hours. I'm mostly standing there.
As a teacher and a married man, too, who's, like, working those kind of hours and then, like, obviously still wanting to spend time with your family, I'm sure that just, like, ends up being, you know, a lot of extra time. And yeah. You had family in town recently, right? So, like, that's part of what, like, just, like, it's good, but it's just, like, that just meant that you had less time to do things like this. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did have my family in last weekend. And then the weekend before, you were singing at the Basilica.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, it's just been busy, busy.
Yeah.
But I think we're doing all right.
Yeah.
It's going to be good. Would you actually ever consider doing, well, no, we'd have to get different equipment.
Like, what, singing, recording?
No, well, no, no. We actually have the equipment, I think, for singing.
Yeah.
Already.
Then what's the other equipment you want?
I was gonna suggest recording, like from distance, but we would.
Oh,
need...
yeah, we could. Well, this mixer that we have has a call-in feature for like a cell phone.
Yeah, I'm not
so
sure.
So we just have to like figure out how to do that. But
and I actually have seen microphone extensions for phones, like.
That's true. You could do that. I mean. Yeah.
But because there's
I mean, we could also test it sometime and see, because it might be fine even with the phone audio, because I think the mixer's supposed to, like, make that better.
Yeah, because we do have plans of moving into the direction of video podcasting,
mm-hmm.
and we kind of have stuff somewhat set up for it. I just need to figure out the software and hardware nature of, which is everything, yeah. of that style of podcasting. But if we're doing, like, there's this podcast called Classical Mind. And I haven't listened to it in a while, but they record at a distance. They're the two co-hosts live states apart, mm-hmm. but they sound like they're right next to each other. So
oh, yeah.
if
mean,
we're
if
not
have the right equipment,
so
yeah.
if we're not doing a video podcast, we might actually be able to get away with the distance, and the listeners won't be able to tell that, like, oh, Reese and Peter are not with each other right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I feel like we're close enough where, like, whether or not we're with each other doesn't really affect the quality of the conversation.
Yeah,
if you don't know someone and you're doing, like, you're zooming in, that clearly affects the quality of the conversation, because a lot of people said that. But good. So today, we actually have been trying to figure out, like, ideas. You know, every time we try and do an episode, like, let's get a theme, let's focus on a certain question. And I think we have a lot in our back pocket.
Yeah, we have some things definitely coming up over the summer, I think, too, once we both are a little bit less busy. But
yeah, but my students have been listening to our podcast, which is cool. And one of them requested that we do an episode. Shout out to Sophie. I'm not going to say Sophie's last name, but yeah, shout out to Sophie. She suggested that we do an episode about just our life story.
Yeah.
And individually. So we're gonna do one episode on Peter and then one on me. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah, I completely agreed. I think that's an awesome thing to,
because we're
especially early on, to kind of share, like, where we've come from, what our journeys are.
I mean, yeah, and we're amazing. So
of course.
We are an inspirational bunch over here, okay? Yeah. On of Mountains and Men. But yeah, so today,
and that's why we have thousands of listeners.
That's thousands of listeners. But so today I'm actually going to be the interviewer, and Peter, you will be the interviewee,
yeah.
which I'm really looking forward to learning a little bit more about you. I have a good idea already of who you are and your life story, but I'm sure I'll get to learn a lot more about you today, mm-hmm. and our listeners will get to learn about the great man behind the mic.
Well, yeah, and then next time, well, the tables are turned, and I'll get to interview you.
Yeah, so. We'll see how that goes. Oh, just a shout out to you, Peter. I joined the ladies' book club.
Oh yeah. I don't know if you should say the name, but yeah.
I think it's fine. I mean, it's not an official name. It's like,
I mean, fair enough.
It's called Ladies Book Club. Ironically, it's a bunch of men, but, we were talking about you yesterday. We were like Blind Peter. Yeah. Blind Peter's awesome. We love Blind Peter. I think someone was saying that they're like, I really miss Blind Peter's insights. Yeah. He has really good insights.
Oh yeah. I mean, that was an awesome group of guys. I loved I mean, getting to like the guys like meet for like a half hour after like an early morning mass on Fridays. And it's definitely like a really cool like opportunity to just talk and like go over a book or a reading or, you know, an encyclical. And
yeah,
it's definitely been a really beneficial group. So
yeah, they are really good guys. Yeah. Love them. Okay. So let's just dive right in.
Sorry. One more thing real quick is just a reminder that, as we've said, I think on the last podcast, but just, if you guys, I know we're doing episodes on ourselves, but still, just in general, if you guys have any questions for us or any like topic ideas or things that you want to send us, remember that Of Mountains and Men podcast at gmail.com is our email, and it'll always be in like the descriptions of our episodes. So just feel free to reach out and email us, or, you know, questions, comments, suggestions, anything. So
excellent. Wonderful. Yeah. I think we did that, but we forgot to mention at the beginning of last episode.
Yeah, so that's why I just wanted to throw that in there. And,
great
yeah.
idea. All right. Are you ready, Peter?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So let's just start off simple. Where were you born? What was your childhood like, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's kind of funny because I always tell people I grew up in Kentucky, which is true. But I actually was born in Mission Hill, California. Which is just outside. It's a suburb of Los Angeles. So I was born in Southern California, which is where I'm the youngest of six kids. So relatively big Catholic family. My family, my older siblings all grew up in like the first part of their lives in California. And then I was born and my dad got his job transferred him from California to Cincinnati, Ohio. And so we moved like 3 or 4 months after I was born.
Oh, okay.
So that's why like I grew up in Northern Kentucky, just across the river from Cincinnati, Ohio. But I was actually born in California, which is always kind of funny because people will be like, where were you born? And I'm like, well, actually I was born in California. Like, because I'll tell people I grew up in Kentucky and they'll be like, oh, so you were born in Kentucky. And it's like, well, actually, technically, no, I was born in California, but...
Well, don't take this the wrong way, but you don't necessarily give off California vibes.
I mean, that's probably because I was only there for like 3 months or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely have more of a Kentucky. I used to, when I was growing up, I always say I was pure Kentuckian. So,
what part of Kentucky?
Well, Northern Kentucky. So it's closer to like the big city that people know in that area is Covington, right. Which is just across the river from Cincinnati. I was a little bit south of that, but.
Did you ever go to? I don't think it's in Kentucky. I think it's in Tennessee. Do you ever go to Dolly? Like, you know Dolly Parton?
Like Dolly Parton?
Yeah, she has that. It's Dolly Land or something like
that. Oh, yeah. That probably is in Tennessee. But no, I don't think I've ever been there.
When I was driving through those states in college, there were signs everywhere for it. And I remember hearing someone say that it was better than Disney. They weren't even like a southerner. Like, they were actually European. They were like, Dolly Land? Better than Disney. I was like, okay.
Oh, man.
But I was curious if...
they must really like the sale.
Yeah, I was curious if that effect made its way to Kentucky. But okay, cool. So you're a Kentucky kid. And yeah. How long did you live there for?
So I lived there for the first 13 years of my life. And then my dad's job, we ended up moving from Kentucky to Maryland when I was 13. So
okay.
Yeah.
So what were those first 13 years like? Household of six?
Yeah, so I was the youngest of six, homeschooled. All my siblings were homeschooled too. So, like the first part of growing up, of course. Well, actually, though, I'm 13 years younger than my older sister, who's the oldest. So she's the oldest, the one girl, and then I have four brothers.
Okay.
And so that meant that, like, if you think about it, just normal math. Like, by the time I was five, she was 18 and like starting college. Okay. So, like, I kind of like. I always joke that I grew up in like the bottom half of the family, sort of, because like the three, like each of my siblings are separated by about 2.5 to 3 years. So it's kind of like the top half of the family, the top three are like, they were, by the time I was like, you know, 10, they were all like 18 or older. So they're all either in college or, you know, out of college or whatever. But yeah, so my two younger brothers, or not younger, but like I'm the youngest, but myself and the two brothers just older than me, the three of us kind of were mostly like homeschooled together and like hung out around the house and stuff. I do remember like probably one of the best things. It's so funny because ironically, as a kid, I watched more TV than I should have. And I always like my one brother, who's like one of the middle brothers, he would always be like, we need to go outside and like play outside. And like, he'd have all these like fun things he would come up with. We had like a decent sized yard. We lived on 1.5 acres. So it wasn't huge, but it was like a good sized yard. And so we had a lot of space that we could like play games in the backyard and stuff like that. And my one brother would always be like, oh, let's go out inside and play and whatever. And I would get so annoyed because I wanted to like watch TV. I was like this like bratty kid who had just like grown up on TV and just wanted to watch TV all day.
I want Fairly Odd Parents. And,
so. Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. That was one of the shows I used to watch. Yeah. And it's so funny, though, because in hindsight, I am so glad that my brother like got us to go outside. And I used to give him so much crap and like resist it. And I'm like, man, I actually wish I had like let that happen more, because I have come to realize as an adult how important being outside is and like how dangerous the culture of like just sitting in front of a screen, whether it be a TV or a computer or whatever, nowadays is. And so like I'm very grateful for that aspect of things.
That's cool. Where's your so you were born, and by the time like you were 5, your oldest sister, your older sibling, oldest sibling was 18 years old. What's it like having a sibling that much older than you? Like,
yeah,
how close are you really with that sibling? Because my grandmother was born and her oldest sibling was 18. I'm just curious. I just can't imagine that because I'm the oldest, obviously.
Yeah, but, I mean, it was definitely a different experience. Like so part of it is like my sister in general has the tendency to, she like, for whatever reason, she just like wanted to be our second mom, basically, for all of us. Like even my brother, who's like only a couple years younger than her, she just like always tried to act like a second mom and was like all bossy and stuff at times. But she also could be like nurturing and stuff. But like it was definitely interesting. Initially I think it was, you know, it was kind of that like older sister, kind of almost like another mom kind of nurturing thing. And then as I got older though, like it's kind of funny because like when I was like, I don't know, like somewhere between like 10 and 13, like my sister would like talk to me about her like relationships and stuff sometimes, and I'd give her advice. So that was interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's just like an interesting dynamic. That's why I kind of say the thing of like the two families almost, because like my three oldest siblings would always talk about things that were like just so different. And like that normal thing too, that everyone experiences on some level of how like, you know, the first kid is typically like treated a lot differently than like the kids down the road. And so like by the time, like the fact that I grew up on a lot of TV was very different, because my sister, who's the oldest, when she was growing up, they barely watched TV, and the only things they ever watched were like old TV shows or movies from like, you know, 60, 70 years ago. And then when I was growing up, I was just watching like whatever the current TV was all the time.
What type of old shows were they watching?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I'm trying to remember all the things that they'd talk about. I mean, it was mostly, like, old movies. Like, my dad loves, like, Laurel and Hardy, if anyone's ever heard of that, or if they want to look it up, it's kind of funny. But the Marx Brothers is, like, old comedy things from, like, the early 1900s, like, black and white movies and stuff like that. I Love Lucy, I remember we watched some, like, things like that.
That's pretty cool. So, household of 6... and a sibling who's like 18 or like 14, 13 years older than you. Any crazy stories from when you were like in Kentucky, ages 4 months old to 13?
You know, honestly, I don't know that like I remember. It's interesting because I don't really remember a ton from like my early years, which may be related to like, to the experience I had when I was 9. But so like when I was 9, I lost part of my vision.
Okay.
Due to a rare gene disorder called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
But it's something that, like, I think that experience just, I think for whatever reason that may have, like, affected, like, the trauma or something may have affected my memories or experience things, or I don't know. Like, although I've also talked with, like, a psychologist about this, and they've pointed out that it might be something too about, like, physical space, that we memories are linked a lot with, like, physical spaces. Mm-hmm. And since we moved when I was 13, I don't have any of those, like, physical spaces to remind me of the things. Like, a lot of people, if they grew up in the neighborhood, or sorry, if they live, like, in the future, even in the same, like, state, and they, like, drive around and they see their old school or their, you know, whatever place like that, they might remember things linked with that because of the physical memory. But, like, I mean, I've been back a few times in Kentucky, and that does sometimes, like, trigger more memories, but
I'm sure.
But yeah, I don't remember a ton other than that, really.
Fascinating. So did you start to go blind at 9, or did it start before then?
Yeah, so that I do have relatively vivid memories of, that it was the summer of 2002. I was 9 years old. I my birthday's in April, so I turned 9, and then we had the baseball season that year, and that was the year at age 9 when we started picking positions. And so I had decided I wanted to be a catcher, which was the position I loved the most, and got all the gear and everything. And, like, that season I didn't play it a ton, but I got to play it more than I had, because, like, the couple of years before that on baseball, we had kind of just, like, rotated positions in general, and yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of, like, people designating positions. And then we had a big enough yard in our house in Kentucky that we would play, like, our family would just, like, my dad's a big baseball guy, and so we would go outside and just, like, play baseball in the yard. Like, we had a big enough yard that as kids we could play that. And I remember sometime in, like, I think it was August of that year, we were outside, like, a few of us, like, playing baseball, and somebody was, like, throwing the ball, and I was, like, having trouble seeing it more than, like, usual. And I was like, this is not good. Like, I've never had an issue seeing the ball before. And so I initially, like, you know, of course, told my parents about that. And we went to an eye doctor, just like a normal, like, optometrist or whatever the, like, glasses doctor is. Mm-hmm. And I have actually, it's really funny, I have a very vivid memory of that, because they tried, like, all the different lenses and, you know, does this help? Does this help? Does this help? And, like, nothing did anything. And then they took my parents aside, and the doctor's, like, over there talking to him, and I actually was able to hear this, that the doctor asks my parents, like, does he have a strong desire for glasses? Like, they were basically wondering if I was faking it. And it's funny, because to be clear to everyone, I don't actually feel this way anymore, but as a small child, I had grown up on things like the Brady Bunch too. Actually, that was one of the TV shows that we watched. And I remember, I think there was a joke in the Brady Bunch about people being, like, Four Eyes who have glasses, like, yeah, oh, look at Four Eyes or whatever. And so as a small child, a 9-year-old, I was like, I don't want glasses. Like, people with glasses are, you know, they look ridiculous or whatever. And
listen, hipsters, people look ridiculous with glasses.
And so, like, I remember, like, being so, it's so funny, the irrational brain of a 9-year-old, that I was so annoyed with that doctor, because I was like, how dare they think that I want glasses? People with glasses look ridiculous. Like, which now, of course, I think if somebody needs glasses to see, praise God, like, that's, you know, that's good. I don't have any, you know, I don't think they look ridiculous. I think it's just a good, necessary thing.
Peter hates people who wear glasses, guys.
So. Yeah.
Everyone should be getting LASIK. All right.
But yeah, so So we went through that, and then I kept losing more vision over the course of the next like couple months, and my family tried to get me like an appointment. This is one of the like messed up things about the medical system, if anyone's had similar issues, of you try to get an appointment with a specialist or whatever, and it's, you know, I think the first appointment I forget the exact thing, my mom knows the details better, but we had gotten an appointment with like a neuro-ophthalmologist or some kind of specialist, but it was for like January. Like that was the first time they had an appointment.
And sorry, what month did you start?
And so it was August when I first started like experiencing some degree of vision loss, and then January. And then my vision just progressively was getting worse. And so my mom took me to our like normal, just like doctor, our MD or whatever. And that doctor, like, obviously they're not an eye doctor, but they examined me and they're like, well, this is not good. Like, this is a problem. So we need to get you into someone like soon. So he was able to get us an appointment sooner. So that was October that we went to see him. And then he got us an appointment in early November, November 14th, actually, which is my brother who's closest to me in age. It's his birthday. And so November,
do you remember ruining his birthday
party? Well, yes, that's why I say that. I remember that very distinctly because November 14th of 2002, we went to see a neuro-ophthalmologist in Cincinnati. Like we drove up to Cincinnati.
Wow.
And this neuro-ophthalmologist had like, I guess the ability and the wherewithal and whatever that he looked behind my eyes with like a device or whatever and saw that my optic nerves were inflamed. Which none of the other doctors had seen because they weren't like a specialist and hadn't really like gone to the trouble to look at that. So he saw behind my eyes that my optic nerves were inflamed. So he was like, we need to get you admitted to Cincinnati Children's Hospital today. So I went from that doctor's office, just like I think it was a couple, like just down the road or a couple blocks or whatever to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which actually at the time was, I think, the number one or two children's hospital in the country. So we went there and I had a spinal tap, which is also called a lumbar puncture, which is not a very fun procedure, wow. I will say, but, they stick a very large needle into your back to get out spinal fluid to test it. And was then admitted, so that we went to the ER initially, technically, like that's how they got us in. And then like,
that's how they're able to run all the tests right away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I was admitted from there, and spent 4.5 days in the hospital with, IV of like steroids, which that's also like one of those funny things that you remember is as a kid, I, again, like baseball was a big thing. And so, and this was 2002. So when I heard steroids, I initially, of course, thought of anabolic steroids, which are the ones that athletes take to get like big muscles or whatever. Had to explain that, like, yeah, these are not those steroids. These are a different type of steroids.
You are not going to start hitting home runs all of a sudden.
Yeah, here. Exactly.
So why were they doing? What were they initially concerned about? Like, what's? I'm sure they were concerned about other things than what ended up eventually being the case.
Yeah, so that was, so because it was the nerves, like it was the optic nerves that were inflamed, the initial questions were they thought it might have been MS, like multiple sclerosis, or some other sort of like nerve disorder that would potentially like degenerate over time. And so that was those few days in the hospital, of course, were kind of nerve wracking, like doctors coming in and out all the time and like trying to, like they were running different tests and trying to figure out what was going on. The one thing about that is that my vision loss stopped at that point. And so we don't know. I've always attributed it to the steroids that they, because it did bring down the inflammation in my optic nerves.
The steroids. Okay.
And so it's possible that that's why it stopped. It's also possible with the disorder that I have that it may have just reached like it's like, you know, finale or climax, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I was going to ask I was going to get to the point eventually, like why do you still have some vision? Yeah. And
yeah,
so you really don't know exactly.
Yeah. So to kind of finish that story and then also tied in with that was, I remember, sorry, to get back to the brother thing real quick. The reason that I know it was my brother's birthday is because when they told us we were going to have to go over to Cincinnati Children's Hospital and then the hospital told us that I was going to be admitted, I was like, I can't be admitted. It's my brother's birthday. Like, I got to go home and like, because we were going to have a birthday dinner and everything. Like, it wasn't even going to be a party, but it was just like a birthday dinner for our family and everything. And I was like, I can't like do that. It's my brother's birthday.
That's nice of you.
But yeah, so, but so then I spent 4.5 days in the hospital. And when I was discharged, they still actually didn't know what was going on. Like, they hadn't actually figured it out. But they, because my vision had stopped getting worse, at least they were like, all right, like, we can discharge you, at least you can go home. And I was still coming back in for like outpatient stuff for a couple weeks. And 2 weeks later was when the test came back positive from this like lab in Kansas that they had sent the test, the some of the blood tests to. That the way it was phrased to us was like somebody just kind of like almost like on a whim tested for this rare gene disorder. And it came back positive, and they were like, oh, this actually makes sense. So it's called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, like I said. Excuse me. Some people shorten it to like LHON or whatever. But basically, it's a gene disorder that people can have the gene disorder and not have any effect from it. They can just be a carrier. Or they can have it and start losing vision at some point. Some people who have it lose vision completely and go completely blind. Other people who have it lose part of their vision and are often left like legally blind, like me, where they're over the limit of legal blindness. That's also why it is that I've had, you know, probably at this point more than 1,000 people in my lifetime have been like, oh, so glasses don't help? And it's like, yeah, glasses don't help because it's not my eyes actually that are the problem. Yeah. It's my optic nerves. So glasses are a correction, which I had to learn this, and I still don't know the like super scientific backing of this, but I know on a basic level that glasses correct vision problems with our eyes versus my, technically speaking, my eyes are fine. Okay. It's the connection between the brain and the eyes. The way that like it was described to me and I think is helpful to a lot of like average people is thinking of it almost like a computer that, you know, your eyes are like the, or like a camera in a computer sort of, that your eyes are the camera that see the image. And then there's a cable that takes that image from the camera to the computer. At least there used to be, I guess nowadays sometimes that's done through Wi-Fi and whatever. But in the old days, there's a cable that takes the image from the camera to the computer. And then the computer processes it and tells you what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. In my case, the cable is the thing that's messed up, not the camera.
Interesting. Yeah. Is there a so with I'm sure with Neuralink potentially becoming a thing, is there anything in the I remember first meeting you and you mentioned this as a possibility. Is there anything up and coming that could restore that vision? Because I know like fixing the eye, like, well, no, we can fix the eye with LASIK, you know. Mm-hmm. But correct, when it comes to the what nerve?
The optic nerve.
The optic nerve. Is there any talks or any advancements on repairing those?
So I don't know anything about the Neuralink thing other than that the whole concept of Neuralink bothers me. And I don't think I would ever want that anywhere near my body because being connected to a computer in that way disturbs me.
Understandable.
But what I do know is that the thing that is a potential option for the future is like gene therapies, so things like CRISPR,
okay,
which was a thing that was developed, I think, gosh, now it's probably been almost 10 years, I think, since it was developed or more. But when I was a missionary at MIT, it was like newer back then, and so it was being talked about a lot. But
that's CRISPR that's preventative, though, right?
Not necessarily. Okay. It can be used on a current like on an individual like now, like to take out genes and update. I mean, again, I'm not a scientist, so I don't understand all the details, but essentially to like update something and have it like you put them back in, I think, and then that's supposed to like somehow like help the other ones to regenerate or update or whatever. So there's a possibility that something like that in the future could be used. Right now, it's still like too experimental and they're not really sure exactly if it would work.
Right.
But there could be ways to like regrow the optic nerve or parts of it in that way. I remember a couple of years ago I looked it up and there were trials being done, I think, on people with my gene disorder involving like gene therapy type things, but they're like very experimental and absurdly expensive. And so it's one of those things where like if we get to a point in the future where it was a reasonable price and the risk involved was relatively low, I would consider it. But at this time in my life, I'm functional enough that to me, it doesn't seem worth taking an absurd risk. And also, like, of course, the money is like absurdly expensive too for these trials and stuff. But
with these trials, that's kind of where we're at. Was there success in these trials? Like, people had their vision restored?
I don't think we had gotten to that point yet. I think they were still just kind of testing it. But
what are some of the side effects of this gene editing?
I'm not a scientist, so I can't speak into that too much, but I don't think we know super well, because I mean it's like any other new thing that it could have side effects that we're not aware of yet, I think. I don't think there's a ton of side effects of it. I think it's more a question of whether it could actually work for something like that.
Especially with the money involved, which makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So your vision started to deteriorate. You said during baseball season, so that's around the spring, right?
Well, it was August. It was after the season.
So it's August. And then by October, so real fast, your vision went from, hey, I can see everything clearly, to I can't see it unless it's so. What can you see exactly? Do you need to? Because I know I've seen you read, and you have to have it right up against your eye, or you're magnifying it with a screen.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think print size, like, I need much bigger than large print, quote unquote. So there's a thing nowadays called large print that's like used for certain people with like minimal visual issues, but large print is like, I think, 16 or 18 point font or something. It's like barely bigger than the norm, like 11 or 12.
Yeah, that's not the
font. I need like to be able to read on a reasonable level. I need something along the lines of like 36 to 48 to like 50 something minimally.
Wow.
To be able to really read font, and it needs to, and even with that, as you've seen as a friend of mine, like I have to have stuff like right in front of me pretty much, mm-hmm. whether it be my phone or something I'm reading, it's very close. So a helpful thing I think that I've learned over the years is, so when we talk about like 20/20 vision, mm-hmm. that means that, generally speaking, that means that something that is 20 feet away, if you have 20/20 vision, something that's 20 feet away from you, you can see as though it's 20 feet away from you, normally speaking. As you go down the visual range, so that first number is the distance thing. The second number is the one. So like my vision, so legally blind is 2200. My vision is 2400 roughly.
Oh, okay.
What that means essentially is if something was 400 feet away, you could see it. Like you as a person with 20/20 vision, you can see that thing 400 feet away.
Okay.
For me, if something is, how do I put this? The 400 feet away thing, I can't see. So the easier way is to bring it down the scale, that like, if you think about that scale and then you bring it down, something that's, why am I all of a sudden blanking on how to explain this? I've explained it to people lots of times before.
I'm imagining I'm in the end zone of a football field.
Yeah.
And you just add an extra, I don't know, 33 yards.
Oh, okay. Sorry. This is how to explain it.
Okay.
The thing that you can see 400 feet away.
Yeah.
I need to be 20 feet away from that to see it.
Okay. And when you see it, do you see it clearly though?
Well, theoretically, I would see the way that you see something 400 feet away, mm-hmm. I would need to be 20 feet away to see it the way you see it.
I see.
So like you think about 400 feet is pretty far away, so you're probably not going to be able to see it super well.
Right.
But you can see it reasonably well in one sense. I need to be 20 feet away to even see it as well as you see it at 400 feet away. So then you bring it down the scale of like 100 feet, I would need to be 5 feet away from that.
So your vision is 5% of... If I'm doing the math right, I'm not sure if that perfectly equates, because 400
feet. I'm trying to think how that math
40
works, but
would
I guess,
be, 40 would be 10%. Cut that in half.
I guess. I mean, yeah. Because if you think about it, so like 20 feet. If you're 20 feet away from something, you probably can see it relatively clearly. I mean, assuming you have 20/20 vision. But the point is, if you have 20/20 vision, you can see it relatively clearly at 20 feet away.
It would need to be 1 foot.
I would need to be 1 foot away from that thing to see it the way you see it at 20 feet away.
Interesting.
So that's how like crazy different the scale is. So I can see things, and I can see them well enough that like we're sitting probably 3 or 4 feet apart from each other right now. Yeah. So I can see you But if you think about, like, so let's think about the math on that. If I'm, like, 3 feet away from you, I probably see, wow, I don't know if I've ever actually thought about this quite this way, but I probably see you the way that you would see someone who's about 60 feet away from you.
That is wild.
That's fascinating, because I don't think I've ever gotten to that kind of, like, specifics before, but that is really interesting.
That is really interesting. Holy crap. I mean, that's now I feel like I have a really good understanding of how you see, because of just this breakdown.
I need to start saying that more to people, because I've always done the, like, the degrees thing, but I've never given quite that example.
Well, you're using the terminology, like, you know, like, yeah, which makes sense. That's what everyone appeals to. But no, yeah, there is almost a simpler way to convey it. Wow.
Wow, that's fascinating. Because even, like, there's a cabinet over here that's probably 5 or 6 feet away from us. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking, like, 5 or 6 feet would be about 100. So that probably makes sense. That I bet if you were 100 feet away from that, you'd probably see it kind of the way I can, which is that...
This is blowing my mind.
That's so interesting to think about.
Wow. Okay.
Because you, at 100 feet away with someone with good vision, you probably could see that there's a cabinet and that there's some things inside it, but you wouldn't really be able to tell what's inside it from 100 feet away, which is where I'm at. Like, I'm 5 feet away and I can tell there's a cabinet and that there's things inside, but I can't tell you anything about what's inside.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly how I would feel if it was 100 feet away. I would be like, oh, there's definitely something inside that cabinet. No idea. Wow.
Wow. I just had a revelation on that too. Wow. That's cool.
That is pretty cool. Okay. So, do you remember the frustration, like the emotional frustration you were experiencing over those few months?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Like, well, wow, that's actually a good question. I remember the emotional frustration afterward. I don't.
Because were you thinking it was going to be undone?
Probably. I mean, I think I just don't have a whole lot of memories from those few months. I think it was such a, like, it was probably so painful that I think you know, maybe I'm over-psychologizing it, but I think that my brain has kind of, like, blocked some of that out as, like, a defense mechanism thing, that it was probably just, like, so traumatic and painful that I don't really remember that time much, mm-hmm. Like, those few months. Like, I have the vivid memory of, like, the baseball thing where, like, just, like, playing out in the yard for fun and not being able to see the ball. And I have one vague memory of my grandfather coming to visit during those couple months. I think it was maybe in September or something of that year. And aside from that, I remember almost nothing from that time period.
Weird. That's interesting. Because, I mean, I know some people undergo a physical change because of some defect or virus. And I've heard things about people who are experiencing, like, tinnitus, where they hear ringing in their ear. Mm-hmm. And it will drive them crazy because they never experience silence anymore because they just hear constant ringing. And some people even become, like, super depressed because of this radical change. And it's something kind of simple, you know, and especially relatively speaking compared to your vision issues. So, yeah, it's probably was a defense mechanism with your brain why you don't remember it. But you said you remember a lot afterwards, like the emotional.
Yeah, I just remember stress. All the, like, the time. I mean, I remember the stay in the hospital reasonably well. And I definitely remember, like, the next couple years that we were in Kentucky after that of, like, just learning how to adapt.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how to live without, you know, as a 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old without a lot of vision.
Did you notice an increase in your hearing during that time?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would say, the way I would phrase it, my impression of it, I mean, maybe this isn't universal, but I think that what people talk about with the, with people who are blind or partially blind or whatever, is it's more an increase in sensitivity to the recognition of that sense. You know, that, like, I don't think my actual sense of hearing improved at all per se, but I think what happened is that my ability to perceive my hearing was emphasized.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Like, the way our senses work as humans is that, kind of like that example of my eyes, we take in data through our physical body, hearing, sight, smell, touch, and then our brain processes that data. And I think because I couldn't see as well, my brain was able to, like, adjust and process the hearing data on a more minute and precise scale. But the interesting thing about the hearing is that something I've learned over the years, my ability to like hear like noises off in the distance and things like that has definitely improved. I found that so much over the years where people will be like, wait, you heard that? Like, or I'll be like, oh, did you hear that thing? And they're like, wait, what? But at the same time, something that I didn't understand until a few years ago, my conversational hearing is just as bad and actually arguably worse than most people. And the reason for that is that most human beings unconsciously read lips when they're in like a crowded room.
Yeah.
Like if you're in a conversation in a big room and there's a lot of noise and talking and music and whatever going on, most people have this innate thing in our brains that as we're conversing with someone, if we can't hear them that well, we see what their lips are, the forming of their lips. And so it helps our brain perceive, oh, they said, you know, whatever word. I can't do that. And so I actually find myself having a lot more trouble, which I think is probably part of the reason that I hate crowded, like, well, not crowded rooms. I don't mind crowded rooms per se. I hate really noisy rooms where it's like, there's a lot of like reverberating conversation or loud music or things like that, because I love conversing with people. That's part of my nature or whatever. And if I'm just like sitting there and we're having to try to shout back and forth from, you know, a couple feet away and I can't hardly understand anything they're saying because I can't read their lips, it's just really frustrating and annoying.
I also remember you explaining to me one time another reason you hate, yeah, the crowded rooms is because you are more sensitive to the noise. So if you and I are having a conversation in a crowded room where there is a lot of noise, you can also hear the noise. Like, I can hear it too, but my brain is for somehow able to shut that off. But you're more sensitive to that sense, so it's, you struggle with it. Like, you have to intentionally ignore that conversation that you're hearing to the side.
Yeah, and that's, you know what's interesting is I just realized, I wonder if, wow, again, I'm having another revelation here, that I wonder if that has to do with what I was, I've never made this connection, but I bet that has to do with what I was just sharing about the lip reading thing, because I've noticed this also with like lectures. Like when I was in college and in seminary, I think a lot of other people, it's easy for them to, not easy, but it's easier for them to sit in a room while someone's lecturing or presenting or whatever, because they're not only listening, but they're also watching that person, and they see the person's movements, the person's gestures, the person's, you know, all the different aspects of the person. And even in a conversation with somebody a couple feet away from me, I'm going to be able to pick up on some of that, but I won't be able to pick up on as much of it as other people, particularly things like facial expressions and lip movements and things like that, that another person would be able to perceive. And so that might be actually part of why it's harder for me to focus sometimes on the, to shut out the other things, because the only sense that I'm really using primarily is hearing. Mm. And so then if I'm hearing us talking, but I'm also hearing a conversation to the side of me, my brain is like, well, wait, which one matters more? Because I'm hearing both of them right now, and it's having trouble deciding because I don't have that like factor of being able to stay as focused on the person in front of me. And I think I've trained myself over the years to be pretty good at that overall, but I do think it's probably harder for me than the average person in that way. Interesting.
Yeah, because there are people who don't have any sense deprived. They don't like there are two communities of podcasts. There are video podcasts and just purely audio podcasts. Mm-hmm. And some people cannot do audio podcasts. They're like, I can't listen to it.
Yeah.
Like I need to see someone. And I remember Jimmy Akin recently talking about that. There are actually some people who are incapable of seeing pictures in their head.
Oh yeah, which that's crazy to me because I do have a really visual mind. But
well, I bet I wouldn't be surprised if your mind adapted a little bit more. It's like, no, you're going to have to be very imaginative.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Just because that's to assist. Cause like whenever I'm reading a book, I like to think that I'm decent somewhat at visualizing things.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see people who have a very difficult time visualizing what's in the book, struggling to get through it, especially like a book written by Tolkien or C.S. Lewis who take some time when it comes to describing the scenery, you know? So you have the ability to imagine. You've kind of made that point clear, right? Mm-hmm. You can picture images.
Very much.
But you do also lack the actual physical experience of seeing, which prevents your, that doesn't necessarily prevent, seeing
as well, but yeah.
But yeah, seeing as well, but you lack that like sufficient sight to the point where it makes it difficult for you to focus on conversations when there's a lot of other things happening.
Yes.
Yeah, which makes sense. Okay. Wow. So you, and I remember you said that if you run into someone in public, it's always, if they say, "Hey, Peter," you're like, "Ah, crap, I can't see you. I have no idea who you are." Like you, but my, when we run into each other, you can tip, you seem like you've picked up on me, but I think it's because my voice is.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think in your case, it's partially because you have a very, very distinct voice.
Right.
That's very helpful. Some people have like really distinct voices. Some people have voices that are a little more similar to other people. And so if it's like a really quick passing where I don't really get a chance to see the person well, the voice can be really helpful sometimes. But
I'm really bad at listening to female voices, like on the phone, just when someone, I mean, I guess
I think I can relate with that, honestly. Like for some reason, I think our phones do something weird and like distort female voices somehow where they like sound really similar.
It's got to be the case. I mean,
because I've experienced that and it's confused me.
It's been several times where my wife's sisters have answered the phone and I'll start the conversation like I'm talking to my wife. Now, they are going to have the same tone or similar tones and similar mannerisms with their speech because, you know, they've grown up together and they talk probably the same way. But I'm like, "Oh, hi, honey." And you're like, "It's not, I'm not your wife. It's this is so and so." Yeah. So definitely.
I could imagine them doing that to you just with, to mess with you. But
yeah. Yeah. No. I usually pick up on it after a couple sentences. But yeah, no, it definitely happens with women for some reason in my ears. So cool. Now, you grew up Catholic.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your faith like in your early life? And how did your, how did the deterioration of your vision affect your relationship with God? So that's a big question.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, actually. It's something that I've reflected on and learned a lot more about myself over the past six-ish years at this point. So I grew up very, well, in a very traditional Catholic family, in the true sense of what traditional Catholic tends to mean. When I was growing up in Kentucky, we were going to the Society of St. Pius X Church,
I didn't know that. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Dang. So it wasn't, to be clear though, to everyone, it was not a specific desire to be out of communion with the church on the part of my parents. It was just that my parents are both older. Particularly my dad is in his late 70s now, so he grew up before Vatican II, actually.
All right.
And my mom grew up somewhat before Vatican II, but was actually Protestant initially growing up. And so my dad and his mom, like, completely rejected Vatican II. Well, okay, sorry. Well, that sounds bad. I just realized how bad that sounds. That's not true. My dad and my grandmother did not like the... Also, I think everyone can probably hear that siren in the background. So
here, you keep talking. I'll just go close the window.
Oh, okay.
Is that, yeah, the windows are open.
Yeah. So basically, my dad and my grandmother, they didn't reject Vatican II, to be clear to everyone, but they had issues with the liturgical changes and abuses, particularly, that happened after Vatican II. And having grown up before those changes, they both, my dad and my grandmother, preferred the old mass, the Latin mass as we know it now. And so after that time period, when a lot of places had changed to doing the Novus Ordo, and honestly, at that time, like in the 70s where my dad was living, there were a lot of abuses, a lot of crazy like clown masses and other things going on. And so they sought out places where the Latin Mass was being done. And at the time when they were living in California, throughout his life, he sought out either the Latin Mass or the Eastern Rite Byzantine liturgy, actually. So funnily enough, by a weird random circumstance that would be a story for another time, my parents actually met each other and got married at an Eastern Rite, Ruthenian Rite Catholic church. Even though they're both Roman Rite Catholics, so they're still Roman Rite, but they got married in Eastern Rite liturgy. And then when we moved to Kentucky, the only real like options for the old mass at the time, because this was the 90s to early 2000s, and this was before Summorum Pontificum, which was Pope Benedict's document that permitted more use of the Latin mass. Before that, it was very few and far between to find it, and mostly it was schismatic groups that were doing it. And a lot of those schismatic groups were small, niche, like offshoots that were particularly and specifically sedevacantist contest, which means that the seat is, it's a Latin phrase for the seat is vacant. They believe the Pope was not actually the Pope, officially, things like that. So my parents determined they wanted to go to the Latin mass, and the only real options were like, there were three options, and two of them were like two of these like small niche schismatic sedevacantist groups. And there was a Society of St. Pius X church that at least like the society officially formally didn't proclaim to be sedevacantist. And they were still, well, at the time they were still, what's the word? They were still not in communion with the church. They're still not in communion, but there was an excommunication that was put on them years ago. Again, this is a story probably for another time in more detail, but
no, it's a good explanation. Just like, what's the SSPX?
But yeah, so there was when they first were founded, they were sanctioned by Rome, like they were permitted to exist. And then the bishop who founded them was dying and had requested to Rome to have a few more, to be able to consecrate a few more bishops to keep the society going. And Rome was dragging their feet on giving a response to him. I think they had denied it initially, but then he had like reappealed or something, and they were kind of delaying on giving a response, and he was dying. And so he did something that is not permitted. He went rogue yeah, and consecrated four bishops without the permission of Rome, which is valid. Those bishops were consecrated validly, but illicitly, yeah, which means illegally, basically. And so that act in and of itself took away their communion with the church. So they excommunicated themselves by that act.
Okay.
And the excommunication was not lifted until the late 2000s when Pope Benedict XVI was Pope. He was trying to see if he could bring the society back into full communion with the church. And he was in talks with the head of the society at the time. And one of the things to like part of the effort in that was, as a show of good faith, he lifted the excommunication. So they're still not in communion with the church. They're not in a regular state of communion is what it's referred to, but they are actually no longer excommunicated. And in 2015, this is another complicated thing that we can go into in the future sometime, but in 2015, Pope Francis gave them faculties, which is a fancy church term for the ability to absolve people in the sacrament of confession, of reconciliation. So they're at least in a much better state than they used to be.
Because they were still, I'm sure, performing those sacraments.
They were, but they didn't have faculties. So now it's, well, yeah, and debatably, it wasn't valid either.
Right. Okay.
Because of the way faculties work for confession. Right, it's right. Only, you have to have normal, regular faculties from the local bishop, the local ordinary of a diocese. Even if you're a separate group, you still need that permission, except in like life or death situations.
Right.
So a priest has the ability in any life or death situation to absolve someone of their sins through the normal course. But if it's not a like emergency life or death situation, in the normal, regular, ordinary means, you have to have permission from the local bishop, and they did not until 2015. So arguably the confessions that people, including my family, were going to were invalid for all those years. Now that's a whole complicated thing, because if you are truly contrite of your sins and through a lack of understanding of your own, you're going to an invalid absolution. Arguably, through extraordinary means, God may forgive you, but you still need to eventually go to a sacramental confession. It's a complicated thing
we can get into
another time. But but basically, yeah. So I grew up in the Society of St. Pius X, which had a lot of drawbacks to it. I mean, obviously, first and foremost is the fact that we weren't technically in communion with the church. And there were also some issues with the type of preaching and philosophy of the society, I think, from what I mean, I was too young to be impacted by a lot of that negatively, because I was 13 when we moved, and I was an altar server as a boy. So mostly what I remember is the absolute profound beauty of the Latin Mass and the liturgy and being able to serve in that. it was an experience that I think has formed me in a really positive way for the rest of my life, to understand like the sacrament of the Mass, of the Eucharist, to understand how important it is to have that beauty, to be able to access that, to worship our Lord in that way. But my older siblings, none of whom are practicing the Catholic faith anymore, I think they were all very negatively impacted, unfortunately, by different aspects of the society. Because I think one of the unfortunate things that I've learned over the years is I think the society has, well, or the people, because a lot of these things aren't formally parts of the society, right, per se, right, but the people who tend to gravitate toward that group tend to be people who not only want the Latin Mass, which is a good thing and a beautiful thing, but they also often have a tendency to want to go back to live as though we still live in like the 1940s or 50s. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that we don't.
Right.
Like there needs to be an understanding of like we live in 2024 now, and that means that things are different than they used to be. And not all those things necessarily are good. Some of them are, some of them aren't, the differences. But we have to acknowledge that they exist and not try to hide ourselves away in some sort of like cloistered 1950s community where, where things are just so different than what they actually are in the world. So I think that formed my perception. And I guess, okay, sorry, answer that question further, because you had asked both about my faith, but then how that impacted my vision loss. I think in hindsight, a lot of this has been recognitions over the last 6 years in hindsight, but growing up, because I grew up in that community that I grew up in, I didn't have an actual relationship with God in like the real sense of relationship. Mm-hmm. I saw God as kind of the lofty figure up in the clouds who was good. Like I perceived him as being good overall, but as very distant, in a non-personal way. And part of that I think is because I just didn't learn to kind of like, I learned how to pray in one sense, but I didn't learn how to pray in a intimate, like reflective, meditative sense. And so that being the case, one of the things that I have learned since then in recent years, about 6 years ago, I had this realization that when I was in the hospital, as a kid at 9 years old, there was a moment. So my mom actually stayed with me in the hospital, even though she had five other kids. Like she stayed with me for most of the time that I was there. And like, she slept on this uncomfortable like couch bed thing. And like, in hindsight, that was very sacrificial and incredibly like meaningful. And through no fault of her own at all, there was one day, I think it was the second day I was there, when my dad's car broke down. And so even though he had been like taking care of everything and dealing with all the stuff with, you know, the five other kids and everything, my mom had to leave for a couple hours to go help out with something. Mm-hmm. And I experienced in that moment this profound like sense of abandonment from my parents, from God, from, you know, everyone. Like I have this very vivid memory of being in the hospital that day and like going, like my mom had been gone for like an hour or two at that point. And so I walked out to the nurse's station and I was like asking them like where my parents were. And it's funny because these are the days back when like cell phones were like almost non-existent, or like the giant like big cell phone things. And so they had me like call with like the phone at the nurse's station. And I don't know if my parents had a cell phone then or if I called the home phone or what, but I called my parents and like talked to them briefly and like they, you know, assured me they were coming back and everything. But I have realized in hindsight, like 6 years ago, I encountered this in prayer with a really good spiritual director, a good Jesuit actually. surprising, I know. No, I'm just kidding. But I realized like that I had this profound sense of abandonment from the Lord in that experience too. And that I had never, until 15 years later, I had never like prayed with that and never really like gone back to that. And this spiritual director like asked me to, he invited me to, or encouraged me to go and take that to prayer for multiple days to like reflect on that and allow myself, if I was sad, if I was angry, if I was hurt, like to bring those emotions to the Lord. Because I'd never, up to that point in my life, I mean, this was at age 24 or 25, like I had never really been fully honest and like expressed my emotions to the Lord. And So that was an experience of realizing just how wounding that whole experience was. Obviously there's the physical vision loss, but I dealt with that and I figured out ways to move forward and everything. And I think part of what happened with that too was the thing of, I had kind of a philosophy, I think, as a kid of, well, I got to just like grit through this and get through and I'll deal with it later. And then that happened for, I kind of had that philosophy for 15 years or whatever, until I finally was like, oh, I need to actually like go back and reflect on this and recognize how difficult this was.
So when you say you remember not a whole lot of when you were losing your vision other than your grandfather visiting, but you remember the hospital, is that what you really remember? Like your parents being gone for those few hours?
I mean, that's the main memory I have from the hospital. Yeah, is the like trauma in a sense of that experience.
Right.
Yeah.
And as you said, like to no fault of
the Yeah, absolutely. But, like my parents listen to this a lot and like I can't be clear enough. Like it's not anything they did wrong. It's just an experience that happened because of, the reality of the world.
Yeah, and I think we all experienced in our childhood like that first moment of when our parents are not there. But yours was in a hospital, which just adds to the intensity of the moment. Also, you don't really know what's going on. You've just lost your vision, not completely, but a good amount of your vision. And there's all these strangers around you. Like it's, and you're in a different state. There's a lot of variables going into that situation that just add to the trauma of it. Wow. So it's something you haven't really dealt with up until the past 6 years.
Yeah.
Really?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow. Let's see. So that had a big impact on your faith. When did you start to turn the corner? Like you said, you've dealt with this issue over the past 6 years pretty well, under the direction, it seems like, at seminary, which is awesome, or from a spiritual director. But what got you to go to seminary? And I know you were a focused missionary. Like what started your more intimate turn towards the Catholic faith?
Yeah, I think I would want to go a little bit back on, like, back further, I think, in history in that way. Well, in my history, but not in history. But so after that, we moved to Maryland, and I was in high school being homeschooled. I was kind of, at that point, I was, in one sense, kind of being homeschooled on my own, because by the time I was in high school, my closest to me brother was, like, a senior and or starting college or whatever, in midway through high school.
Before actually you get into, did you like being homeschooled?
That's a very complicated question.
Oh, it's a complicated, yeah.
I think homeschooling is a really good thing. That's how I'm going to answer that for right now.
Okay. All right, cool. I know that's kind of a different topic, but...
That's okay. I mean, we can talk about that in the future maybe, but I think I'll leave that at that for right now.
Sounds good. But yeah, you're turning to...
But yeah, I had gotten involved with like a youth group through like homeschool things when we moved to Maryland. And senior year of high school, I went to like a retreat with that. And so I've thanked the Lord for this, that I've always had like some degree of like, even though I said I didn't have like a personal relationship with him, I've also always had kind of a sense and a relationship with God where I desired to do the good, whether it was for the good, for the right reasons or not. Like even throughout high school, when I was like falling to a lot of personal sin that a lot of guys struggle with and like just kind of drifting through life in one sense, I still would go to the sacrament of confession very regularly.
Good.
And was like always wanting to go to mass and just always desirous of doing the good, even when I was struggling and not living it well. And so my senior year of high school, I went on this retreat with this homeschool like teen group or whatever, and we had adoration on the retreat. And I think it was one of the first times I'd actually been to adoration, probably. And adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, so like the Eucharist exposed on the altar in a monstrance. And I was praying in that experience, and they offered confession. And for whatever reason, I just felt this desire to go to confession. And throughout my life up to that point, when I was a kid, I had learned to go to confession in this very rote kind of way where I would like it kind of made sense as a little kid, but then I never like changed that growing up, that I would just kind of recount like, oh, like I I disobeyed my parents X number of days. This is a funny phrase. I don't know if I've ever told other people this, but I used to say, this was like what I was taught as a kid. I fought and quarreled with my brothers each day for a week or something like that. Like it was these like really specific, like rote phrases, which again, like I think that's okay for a little kid, but yeah. I just never learned to like get past that. And so it was for the first time in like as a senior in high school, for whatever reason, the Lord like really helped me to get to the place where I was like, I need to confess the things that I'm actually doing. And I knew that the sexual sins that I was committing on my own were very much like against the Lord's, will and were not good. And so I went to confession and like actually told the priest like everything for the first time. And I think I cried. I'm pretty sure like it was a very nice. Like emotional, like beautiful experience. And that was like the beginning of kind of the turning point of realizing like, wow, I need to actually like try to like, I had had this innate desire to live well, live good. But like, I just like, that was like the beginning of the turning point. And then the next step along that path, the Lord has had a lot of like powerful moments in my life, I guess. But the next step along that path was, so that was senior year of high school. I started college that fall. And I wanted to go to Franciscan, actually, Franciscan University of Steubenville, where Reese went. I really, really wanted to go to Franciscan. I had friends who had gone off to Franciscan. I actually came to visit Franciscan the year before I entered college. And the only reason I couldn't was because Franciscan is very expensive. And I was getting, thankfully, like, praise God for this, because I don't have student loans because of this, but, because of the unfortunate nature of my visual situation that I'm legally blind, the state provided like funds for me to go to college up to a certain amount. And the max amount was the biggest state school in the state of Maryland, which is University of Maryland College Park. But that's not anywhere near how expensive as most private schools are.
Especially back then. Which isn't that long ago, but yeah.
It was. Yeah, exactly. And so I really wanted to go to Franciscan. I actually even like had been accepted, went to like the summer. This was back when Franciscan had like summer orientation things.
They did those.
Oh, do they still do
it? I mean, okay. I'm not that much younger than you, but okay, I believe they still do those.
So I actually went to the summer orientation thing and everything and like met some other people there who I thought I was going to be there with. And then it just became clear. It was like, all right, I can't afford this. I can't do this. Man. So I went to community college for a couple years here in Maryland. And my first year of college, my older brother, Paul, so my siblings are Mary, Joe, Paul, Gregory, Robert, and me. So bunch of very like traditional standard, like Catholic names. But my older brother, Paul, who is the third oldest, he was 26, and January of 2012, he just passed away suddenly in his sleep. Unexpectedly, like none of us were expecting that, obviously. At age 26, he was about to turn 27 in like a few weeks from then. And so that was January of my first year in college, and obviously a very formative like time in your life in general, 18 or whatever. And that experience was probably like the biggest turning point for me though, actually, in my faith journey. So we went to when we moved to Maryland, sorry to go back a little bit. When we moved to Maryland, my three older siblings, Mary, Jo, and Paul, stayed in Kentucky. They were all in college or out of college at that point, and they actually got an apartment together and stayed in Kentucky because two of them were in college. They didn't want to move at that point, and so it was just like, all right, we're just going to do this. So we kind of like, that's part of why I joke about the family thing too, because we kind of like had to split the family a little bit at that point.
Yeah.
So my two, siblings closest to me in age and me moved to Maryland with my parents. So Paul was still in Kentucky actually back then, when he passed away. And so we went back to Kentucky for for his like wake and funeral and everything. And I got to see firsthand the powerful journey that he had experienced. And we actually found a talk, which, now that I think about it, maybe we can post that in the description of this, of this episode. Cause we published it on YouTube a few years ago, but, we found a talk that my brother had given, before he passed away. So to give a really quick kind of synopsis of my brother's journey, he was, like me, grew up Catholic or whatever, and kind of drifted away from his faith in college. And then the last year he was at, he was at college, he lost all of his vision. He went completely blind due to the same gene disorder as me.
Okay.
And funnily enough, or, you know, the grace of God or whatever, at that time, he had started to kind of re-enter the faith. And so he got really involved with the Catholic community at his college and really, like, came alive for the Lord. And actually, it's funny, too, because just on a basic, like, virtue level, too, he had been kind of getting C's and just kind of barely passing through his school and, like, not really doing well and, like, you know, partying and drinking and whatever. And as he, like, came back into his relationship with the Lord and, like, lost his vision all at the same time, he realized he wanted to live excellence, too. And so he, like, the last couple years of college, he got his grades, like, way up, like, got a really, like, got a degree and everything.
I'm sure he had to teach himself how to read Braille real fast.
He did, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's, he learned all that stuff, like, really well. And, like, it was hard for him, but he definitely adapted. And the last couple years of his life before he passed away, he had started giving talks on why we should reverence the holy name of Jesus. And he was giving kind of his testimony as part of these talks, in a sense. And so we found, I kind of vaguely, because, you know, he was whatever it was, like 20, well, he was 26 when he passed away, but he was 8 years older than me, I guess. So, like, during that journey when he was in college and, like, past that, I was, like, you know, in high school and kind of not really paying a whole lot of attention to that. He was kind of my dorky older brother. And so, like, I knew some about that. I knew that he was, like, the Catholic one who I could kind of go to because the rest of my siblings had all kind of stopped practicing their faith at that point. But I didn't, like, have a close relationship with him at the time. And so we heard that. We found this, like, this recording of this talk that he had given, like, a month before he passed away. And we listened to it, and we listened to it, I think, in Kentucky while we were there. And then we had, like, the funeral and the wake service, and I just saw, like, the beauty of this talk and how many people came to the funeral and the wake and everything. And there was something that was just so powerfully struck in me of realizing I just had this sense of, like, I am, like, just kind of languishing through life right now. Like, at the time, I had been kind of just, you know, going through the day-to-day things, still struggling with the sexual sins that I struggled with, like, still not living well at all, just kind of, you know, going to the sacraments, but, like, it was just going through the motions, basically. And I felt this very clear sense of, like, we are all called to, like, greatness. Like, we are all called to do something with our lives. And, like, I desire to, like, do that. And this talk that he gave, he talked all about how, like, he had, you know, he had gone completely blind. He had been hit by a car before that, or, well, during that whole experience or whatever. He just had had all these, like, trials. And he was, like, through all of it, I, like Job, can say, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And it was such a powerful thing to see the witness of, like, in all this suffering, he still saw, like, the goodness of God. And so that experience, like, awoke in me this like, clear desire to live for the Lord, to live for God, and to realize that, I think it also helped me realize, like, we don't know when we're going to die. Like, we have, you know, as tragic as it was, we have a finite amount of time on this earth. And so, like, live well, like, do what we can. And so that was what kind of spurred me to get involved with the cat. When I then transferred to Towson University for the rest of my degree, I got involved with the Catholic campus ministry there. And I was like, I'm going to really get involved with this. And I did. And that began kind of a journey of the past 10 years of, I met a couple guys there who built, like, a good friendship with me, and they invited me into relationship with them and friendship. And a couple of them were discerning the priesthood with the vocation director at the time. One of them is Father Luke Koski, who we had on the podcast a couple episodes ago. And we started going to mass, like, very regularly. There was one summer, like, my second year at Towson, when we went, the group of guys and I, like, went to mass, like, every day over the summer, pretty much. And we would, every day we'd go to like, daily mass at the church here in Towson. And then we would walk to the bagel place, and we'd get bagels, and we'd talk about, like, philosophy and theology and stuff. And, like, the two of them, like, understood philosophy a lot better than me at the time. And so I was sitting there mostly just like, man, this is, like, crazy, like, over my head. But now I could hold my own in a conversation like that. But so that, like, kind of began my journey. I started learning how to pray, and we have an adoration chapel here in Towson. And we would go to adoration during that summer a lot. And like, I began to like actually build a relationship with the Lord. And so long and short version is kind of that I started doing that at Towson. And then my last year at Towson, we got Focus Missionaries, so the Fellowship of Catholic University Students who send missionaries to college campuses. And it was through them coming to Towson and being really involved there that they invited me to be a missionary because of how involved I was with the Catholic campus ministry. I was the president of the Newman Center that year and everything. And initially I was kind of like, no, like I have a job. I actually had a job lined up with the accounting firm that I work at now. And I was like, no, like it's good. I thought about it, but then I was like, no, like I think I'm just going to stick with what I have. And then I went to the Focus conference that they have every year, that year in January, like halfway through that academic year. And I really felt this call at that conference to be open to being a missionary. And the Lord made it clear through prayer at that conference that he wanted me to at least like apply and kind of see where, you know, if it was his call that it would all be like what he wanted and it would work out. And I applied and went to an interview weekend with Focus, and it all, like, I just loved the people I was, you know, meeting and like hanging out with, and it just seemed like a really good fit. And they, you know, called me a couple weeks later and offered me the position. And I actually had, for the first time, my spiritual director back then, a really good holy priest of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, Father James Borick, actually. He had always talked about having this sense of peace. He's like, you need to go where the peace is. And I never felt that. I was always like, what are you talking about? Like, what is this peace? Like, I don't feel this at all. Like, I don't know what this is. And it was the first time I ever experienced that was after I got the call saying that, like, you know, they were offering me the position as a Focus missionary. I kind of immediately had this sense of just like peace of like, wow, this is good. Like, this is what I should do. And I called him and like asked him about it. And he was like, yeah, that sounds right. And so I went and did that. And I fundraised my salary for a couple of years and was a missionary. And it was really through my experience as a Focus missionary. So Focus missionaries, part of the thing that we commit to is going to daily mass every day and praying a holy hour in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament every day. And so whether you like it or not, even if it's kind of annoying when you first start out, in some ways, you are almost like forced to grow in your relationship with the Lord. And that was so beautiful and so formative for me. And that's where it was that summer of my second year in Focus, so summer of 2017, so I guess almost 7 years ago now, that I was in spiritual direction with a really good priest when I was in Focus. And he's the one who invited me to start praying with my vision loss. And that was where I began that kind of journey of healing is what I talk about it as. Like, I haven't had physical healing yet, although I still sometimes pray for that. But just like the emotional and spiritual and mental healing of my relationship with the Lord and others. And kind of getting to that place, I guess. Sorry, that was a lot.
That was awesome, though. My goodness, there's a lot to unpack there. So your brother passing was a big turning point, it seems like, for you.
Yeah.
Like, your brother beyond the grave left an impression on you because of this talk that you guys knew he was doing and giving, but, mm-hmm. like, you actually watched it. So did you guys ever find out exactly what led to your brother's sudden death? Was it a heart failure?
His heart just stopped. That was all. They actually did an autopsy because it was such a rare, like, you know, because he was 26 and there wasn't any clear. He was just, like, he went to bed one night and didn't wake up.
Yeah. I know that happens sometimes.
My sister, my older sister, was never satisfied with that answer. Like, she's always been like, there must have been some reason. But
she's the one who probably found him.
No, actually, unfortunately, it was my brother Gregory, who's the second from me in age or whatever. But
Oh my gosh.
I can't imagine that. That would be horrifyingly traumatic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a terrifying experience that I hope none of us ever really have to experience. But so your brother passes away unexpectedly, has this radical impact on you because of his radical conversion, which is just absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a beautiful story that through these trials, something beautiful is able to be drawn out of what appears to be disgusting.
Yep.
Just absolutely evil. But we believe in a God who can pull the good out of such terrible experiences, and that seems to have happened. And then seems like God really blessed you with some people in college. Like, mm-hmm. as a man who went to Franciscan, I'm assuming the reason you wanted to go to Franciscan was to experience an intimate Catholic community.
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
And it seems mm-hmm. like God provided that for you, even though you didn't go to Franciscan at Towson, with men like Father Luke Kosky and the other guys. And mm-hmm. that's awesome. And I totally can sympathize with you when you say you're in these conversations and clearly they're just going over your head
yeah.
and you're just trying to catch up and not sound like a complete fool. But those are really good guys who you had, who I'm sure, even if you did sound like a fool, they're like,
yeah, well, yeah. And they tried to help me like understand these concepts too. So
definitely. And then focus mission, you were a focus missionary at MIT mm-hmm. in for 3 years,
2 years,
2 years, 2 years. Okay. Yeah. Fundraising the salary. Oh my gosh. I would hate having to do that.
Yeah.
To fundraise a salary.
You know, I will say though, real quick about the fundraising thing, that was the thing probably that like in some ways scared me the most about being a focus missionary. I think it's the thing that keeps a lot of people back. But one of the things that I've found is a great grace from that is it gave me, I prayed with it a lot when I was doing it. And it gave me two really big things that have been instrumental in my life since then is more of a sense of radical trust in the Lord, because I really had to just give it to the Lord and be like, look, if you want me to do this, I will put in, I have to put in the work, but like, you're going to have to give me the people who will support me, who will give me the funding that I need.
So did you get some surprises when you made phone calls? And like,
oh yeah. Them? Oh yeah. Like, there were people I was surprised about. There was one person who I didn't even really know who gave me like a $5,000 gift that I was not expecting. And I've prayed for that person since, because they've since passed away actually, but they were older, but it was just such a beautiful like experience. And to that point, that's the other aspect of it that was so profound for me, is learning how to receive gifts from people. Because I think that is something I've learned over the years is so hard for so many people that I know. Where like, even on a really basic level of like, you'll offer to like, you know, buy their meal or something, and they'll be like, no, no, it's okay, I got it. And it's like, I have like learned through that experience as a focus missionary, it really helped me to learn the concept. And I love to share it too, of like the sense that we nowadays will be like, no, no, it's okay, I got it. But what we're not realizing in that is that we are actually depriving that other person who's offering, we're depriving them of the opportunity to do a charitable act, to do something nice for someone. And in a like certain weird sort of sense, it actually can be really like good for them, that like, not, it's not meant in some sort of unhealthy sense, but you can get a good feeling from doing that. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing, that like recognizing that like, oh, like I gave this person this thing, or I helped them with this. Like, it's not in a prideful sense, but it's in a sense of like community of that. That's a good way to put it. It's like in the sense of community and friendship and stuff, that like you recognize that we should be mutually helping each other anyway. And that help doesn't always have to come with strings attached. Yeah. Sometimes it can be as simple as like, hey, let me buy your drink. Like, yeah, sure.
Well,
like,
typically we can pick up on that too when people are giving of themselves to us, but for some ulterior motive. You know, we can sense like there's something deprived happening here. But when it's given like with no strings attached, I mean, yeah, but what you were getting to.
But I think people so often struggle with that, though, of like, if something is given, even with no strings attached nowadays, people have this like, this obsessive understanding of like independence and stuff, that like, well, I don't want to feel like I'm, you know, dependent on that person or a burden, right, or that I'm mooching off of them or whatever. And it's like, just allow them to like do something for you. That's why like nowadays, if people offer to buy me something or like, you know, whatever, I almost never say no. I'm almost always just like, oh, thank you. Wow. That's so nice. Thank you. Like, because like, that's how I've learned that, because I will do that for other people, and it drives me insane if they push back. I'm like, just let me do this.
Just say
like,
thank you, please.
Yeah, exactly. Right. All you have to do is say thank you and like move on. Like,
yeah, there is a virtue in learning how to say thank you. Yeah. And just accepting,
because part of it, I think, comes down to allowing people to love you too, in the sense of like, allowing them to enter in and to do something for you.
Wow. Yeah. It's maybe there's that the symptom of being unable to say thank you is the result of a greater problem of being uncomfortable with accepting affection and love.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
And to call my wife out, when I call her beautiful, she always makes like a funny face. And I'm like, stop doing that. Okay. All right. You're beautiful. All right. Don't be awkward. I'm complimenting you. You're gorgeous. And she's like, but I do the same thing too. So I'm kind of a hypocrite.
No, I
but,
know. But we all do in ways.
Yeah. But there is something about accepting the compliments of others and doing it well. And because you do diminish the gift from the person when you try and give it back and be like, oh, no, don't. You don't have to do that.
Well, because in the nature, just to kind of conclude that for me, in the nature of the concept of a gift, it has to be freely given and freely accepted.
Yeah.
And that's one of the, I think, the sad things that has happened so often nowadays is people think of gifts, I think, a lot of the time nowadays, partially because of the culture around things like holidays and stuff where people give gifts and you mutually give gifts, that people often think of gifts as like this mutual thing almost of like, oh, well, if I give you a gift, then you now need to give me a gift back in order for us to be like even or something. Oh, and dude, it's like, that's not how that's supposed to be at all.
So I friggin' crushed the Hunger Games series over spring break.
Nice.
I can't stand Katniss, okay? Because what motivates a lot of her actions is obligation. Like Peeta, the only
real reason. Something good to be said about obligation sometimes, but.
Well, no, but like the obligation to reciprocate a gift, which like, yes, love should be reciprocated, but it's like,
it's not. The fact that because he loves her, she's like, oh, well, I have to love him back.
Or like, I have to do this, or I have to, like, I don't like owing someone. And it's like, I think that's one of the reasons I despise Katniss. But
no, that's fair. That makes sense.
It's
like
Peeta does things out of the kindness of his heart and expects.
He does. Yeah. He does. Yep.
Katniss is like, oh, I have to give that back now. It's like,
no, that's a great point.
Yeah. It's the wrong mentality. Totally. So beautiful. Yeah. So Focus really taught you to learn to say thank you and to be appreciative.
To receive gifts. Yeah.
So that's a good lesson right there. You also went on to talk about how being almost like you weren't forced. I don't think Focus was like, hey, did you go to mass today? Are you praying? But I'm sure things would catch on, like people would notice, like, oh, Peeta, you're not.
I mean, we sort of were, and it forced in so far that, like, you're with a team of other missionaries.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
typically,
so
it's like two men and two women. And so, like, every day except for your off day, which is only one day a week, you're going to Mass and Holy Hour with your team.
Okay.
And then, even on your off day, typically your team director would, not on your off day, but like your team director will typically check in with you to make sure that you're, like, still doing it on a regular basis on your off days. So there is accountability in a good way.
There's something to be said, and I'm trying to figure this out as a teacher, in forcing someone to do something. Like, there is.
Oh, for sure. I agree.
Because I think about this when I'm, like, planning retreats, you know, and there's always this stigma of, like, oh, no, we shouldn't force the kids into a situation like this. Like, some people would even think, like, adoration or something, or small groups. But I look back on my own development, and there were things that I was forced into. I didn't really want to, and went on to have great experiences because someone
same here
forced me into it. Yeah. And it's I haven't figured out that relationship really yet, like between forcing and but also letting people go on their own path. I don't know.
No, I think it's difficult. I think there's a middle ground that can be hard to find at times. But I think another, like, since we're talking about my history and stuff, I think one of the positive things that I experienced is, like, you know, my parents had a really positive impact in that way of, A, we always mass, I think we missed mass maybe twice as kids, and it was always because of severe weather, like snowstorms or something, which is, yeah, exactly, like, completely justified. But the point is, and even when we did miss mass on those days, we would still, like, read the readings and, like, do, like, a prayer thing at home. But, like, my point is, Sunday was always, like, very much a day of going to mass, praying, like, it was emphasized as the most important, clearly, day of the week in that sense. And then also, we prayed a family rosary. To my mind, I think it was, like, every night for a while growing up. And it's so funny because it's one of those things that, like, as a kid, I kind of hated it in some ways. And looking back, I am so profoundly grateful. Because it gave me an appreciation for the rosary, for prayer, for, you know, the importance of that. And so, like, I think there's middle grounds that we can find with that. But I do think that overall it was really, like, a positive thing.
That's awesome. Yeah, because my kids, like, I think you were over one time, and we haven't actually done it in a while because we've been so busy. But it's something we need to get back into. Is, like, my kids are younger, so a full rosary might be a little much, but like you said, there's a middle ground, you know?
But like doing like a decade, right? That's what you did when I was there. Yeah, that was really beautiful.
Yeah, no, that was fun. The kids are attached to their rosaries,
good,
which is nice. But There's also something else you said when you were praying for God to provide for you because you're fundraising your salary. You're like, God, you want me to do this? I'm going to do the work, obviously, but you're going to have to like surprise me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a beautiful way to address discernment. I think it's like, God, I'm pretty sure this is what you want me to do, you know? And this seems kind of crazy. I'm taking a big leap here. I'm going to put in the work. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to sit on the couch and just wait for you to do your thing for me. But I'm going to need something here, buddy, you know? And I think there's this concept of radical surrender that I think we're missing nowadays because we are obsessed with the concept of control, especially as men. I think we struggle with that more. Well, in different senses. Yeah, we struggle with the need to protect. I think there's a beautiful lesson in that as well. And it's wonderful to see how God did provide. And that's a sign of proper discernment as well. So awesome. Did you get to the point? Did you just stop at Focus Mission when you were talking? Or did you talk about what you did after you were a Focus Missionary?
I don't think I got to that
yet.
Okay,
so because I know what happens next. But so you're a Focus Missionary. You're in your last year.
So at MIT. I guess to kind of resume in like that summer of 2017, going into my second year as a Focus Missionary, that experience of praying with the sense of abandonment and like really encountering that in prayer, I took that to prayer. I guess it's good to tell this story. I think it's helpful that I took that to prayer at training that summer after the spiritual director recommended it. And the next couple days were like really difficult because it was like emotionally draining because I would bring it up and there were all these feelings of like sadness, anger at God, anger at the situation, frustration, just like hurt, all of it. But I brought it to the Lord and I was like, look, this is how I feel. For the first time, really, I was like open with the Lord about my feelings. Focus has this great thing that they talk about a lot of like how God is a loving father who wants to give us good gifts. And so I started praying with that in adoration at this retreat that we were at that summer for Focus. And I was asking the question very angrily of God of like, where is the gift in this? I was like, where is the gift in this situation of my, you know, of my vision loss and everything? And I heard, not in a audible sense, but in the, people call it locution sometimes, but like in the internal like heart sense in prayer, I heard this response from the Lord of, your life is the gift and I want you to give that back to me. And that was like kind of, that was another like turning point for me. Of it just gave me that first year as a Focus Missionary had been so like difficult in certain ways because I think a lot of the things that I had hidden behind for a long time were getting stripped away in a really positive way. I remember describing going into that summer as being kind of raw. Like I was like, I just realized that I needed to like grow. There were a lot of areas that I was not living virtuously and just kind of slacking off and whatever. And it was because I think I had this sense of like, how I needed to like do these things to earn God's love or whatever. And that experience was a big turning point of recognizing like God does love me and has, you know, the gift of life that he has given me is a great gift. And then he desires me to give that back to him. And so later that summer, that kind of began this journey of transformation that then later that summer, I then had an encounter in prayer with the Lord again, inviting me to go to seminary, which I had discerned when I was in college and had actually almost gone. I had almost applied to seminary my last year of college. And then kind of at the time, I think I was scared in a sense and ran away. And so Focus ended up being the way that God kind of brought me to that even more through that healing. And it was through that healing that I experienced. So part of it was also due to this sense that because of my vision, how could I be a priest? Like, how could I do the things that a priest would do? How would I be able to do this? It was this sense of kind of weakness and like, I can't do this. And it finally became kind of to the point you made a couple minutes ago of this sense of surrender of like, look, Lord, if this is what you're calling me to do, then I trust that you will provide what I need to do it. And so I'm going to try this. And so I felt this call again to enter seminary. And I also had a healthier perception at that point too, that entering seminary did not automatically mean you become a priest. It means you go to seminary to be formed to become a priest, but you're not done discerning either. You continue to pray and discern. And so I then, my last year in Focus, I applied to the seminary here in Baltimore for the Archdiocese of Baltimore. And I was accepted and entered seminary in fall of 2018. And my attitude entering seminary was the same attitude that I had when I left seminary, which was that I am here to pursue priesthood. And in the same kind of, I actually thought of it just now in comparison to what you were saying about the attitude toward fundraising, kind of that it was like this thing of, I'm going to pursue this until and unless I have a clear sense that the Lord is not calling me to become a priest. Because one of the dangers that people have in discernment a lot in general is, Lord, tell me what you want me to do. And the problem with that question is, most people and most of the time, the Lord's not going to shine a light into our life and be like, I want you to go do this. Well, yeah, I want you to now go do that.
Right.
What's going to happen is, through the normal course of life, if you are in a relationship with the Lord and you are praying, going to the sacraments of the Eucharist and confession and all the sacraments that you can receive on a regular basis, if you're praying and trusting in the Lord and receiving the sacraments and pursuing Him, those things will become clear as you progress through life. But there's a great phrase that a priest who wrote a book on discernment says, God can't drive a parked car. And his point is that eventually we have to make decisions and pursue things. And then as we're pursuing that thing, we can see, does it seem that the Lord is blessing this and is encouraging us to go along this path? Or does it seem that the Lord is saying, this is not right. I want you to, you know, pivot, to move to a different path. And so that was my attitude entering seminary, which is also why I was able to discern out the way that I did. But yeah, so I spent 4 years of really good discernment and time and growth and virtue and learning philosophy and theology in seminary, very much believing for those 4 years that I was going to be, well, for at least 3 of those 4 years that I was going to become a priest. And then it became clear my last year through some experiences that the Lord was calling me let's leave it at that for the moment. And then if there's anything you want to say, and then I can move through the rest of that. But
no, I love your insight on discernment, because I think the biggest roadblock to discernment is ourselves. And especially, you know, as a father and as a husband, as a teacher, I'm constantly going through the question, is this where we're supposed to be at? Do I need to do X, Y, or Z? What do you want me to do, Lord? And I noticed that I want the answer immediately.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works. you got it. Like, I think one thing with discernment is we're like, okay, I'm going to discern that. And then we're just waiting for God's response. It's like, no, you have to act. You need to move forward. Okay. There's this thing of discernment of like, you give it to God and then you let it go.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's difficult, requires some humility, requires a whole lot of patience. But I think in moments of my life where I've had to discern, the philosophy you just expressed is what has always worked the best, is give it to God, and then you make a decision that seems the best and see if God blesses it or doesn't.
Yeah.
I love that. So what was seminary like? Did you enjoy that? Like those 4 years?
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting experience. It was incredibly challenging in some ways, but incredibly formative overall. And I grew in virtue in a lot of ways through the fraternity. I think probably the best part of seminary for me was the fraternity of just having so many other guys who are also pursuing virtue. None of us were perfect. We all made mistakes and fell and committed sins and whatever at times, but we were all striving for the same thing of like really pursuing the Lord and His church and loving Him and others. And so that was really helpful to grow in virtue. I met some really good guys who I grew with in relationship, and then those guys challenged me to do better. That was the thing. And so that was really formative. And then I also like understood, like I had more of an appreciation of the liturgy, the mass, and prayer, kind of my own relationship with the Lord, and a lot of continued like healing and processing through things. And actually, yeah, I mean, I don't think I really mind sharing this. I don't think it's that big a deal that like, I like in seminary for the first time, I think it was my spiritual director or someone suggested doing counseling, like meeting with a therapist to talk about some things, particularly to do with like my vision loss and everything. And I actually have found that I have found a really, well, through the seminary, we had connections with a Catholic therapy program. Nice. So I do think that it's important for Catholics to have a Catholic therapist, because they need to be able to understand like the basic, you know, spirit connections between the spiritual life and psychology and all that. But But I found that to be really, really helpful to my own growth too. Actually, there was a lot of healing that has come through that too, through being able to like understand myself better and why I have, you know, why I do the things I do sometimes, what my desires lead toward, things like that. And just kind of to understand fatherhood, both in a spiritual sense of like what a priest does and in the paternal, like physical sense of what, you know, a husband and father like you do does. Obviously I can't understand either of those fully until I experience them, but being able to understand them a little bit more in a real sense of the, you know, the philosophy and psychology and theology behind those things, was definitely helpful. And I think the experience, like, I don't know if I've ever, I guess I've shared this a little bit, but so my going into the spring of my, well, the year before my last year of seminary, I had this experience of, I was like 27 or whatever it was and had never held a baby in my entire life. Part of that was because, partially because of my vision, I think I was terrified of little kids. Not that I don't think they're great. I do. But I was just like, they're like small and like, what do you do with them? And like, yeah, they're breakable. Like, and they like cry or say things and it's just like scary. And I was at a park with some friends during, because it was like post COVID time. And so we were still like not really meeting inside places. So we met at a park and like a couple of my friends had little kids and one of them like needed to go use the restroom and like was like, hey, can you hold my like daughter? And it's like her 8-month-old daughter. And so I was like, sure. Like, and I held this little girl and for the first time in my life holding a small child. And she like wrapped her like little hand around my thumb.
Oh yeah.
And it was just like so adorable. And there was something in my heart that was just like, wow, I actually could be a father. Like I had never actually legitimately considered that possibility. Like even though I had like had a lot of attraction to women at times and wanted to date people and like I hadn't really done a whole lot of dating before that, before I entered seminary, I mean, and I'd had a desire for it on just like a basic level, but I had never thought of it in the real sense of like I could do this. And again, one of the things that then happened over the next year was praying with and talking through it in psychology and therapy and like realizing that because of my vision again, I had not ever really thought that I could do it because I was like, how would I be able to be a father? Like there's so many things that I can't, you know, I can't drive. Like that's such a, like for some reason in my mind, that's been linked as such an important thing that like, how can I do these things if I can't drive? And so that kind of began a discernment where because that desire awoke in my heart, I was like, well, this could be the natural desire because every good and holy priest should have a natural desire for being a husband and father. It's just a natural human thing that we should experience. Mm-hmm. And so I had to kind of discern over the next year, is this just the natural desire that every priest should have? Or is this something deeper where the Lord is calling me to pursue marriage and family life? And so long story short, I went through that next year and December of that year, I actually had thought that I was kind of like settled with the question and was like, you know what? I think I'm at least for right now, I'm like solid. I'm going to keep going along in seminary. Like I'm feeling good about this. December of 2021, I went to a friend's wedding at St. Alphonsus Church in Baltimore. Beautiful, beautiful church in the Latin. Their wedding was in the Latin Mass. And received communion at this wedding. I was sitting in choir as a seminarian, so I was in the sanctuary. So I received communion like really early, and then the priests had to distribute communion to everyone else. So I had like a good solid like 10-15 minutes to pray. It took a while to get through communion. And I was sitting there praying in this beautiful church after receiving our Lord, and I just had this, and I was not expecting this at all. I wasn't even praying about this, but I just had this like, again, this sense of the Lord saying to me in prayer, this is your home. And this is where I want you to bring your family. And that like shook me. And I was like, what? And so then I prayed with that more. And I talked to my spiritual director. And it just, what I ended up deciding, that was in December. And I decided, all right, with my spiritual director, he helped me like realize, because I initially had this thing of like, oh my gosh, like, should I just like leave seminary now? Like we're about to, like we're on break now for the winter. Like, should I just not come back in the spring? And he's like, look. And because I also had this like irrational thing of like, well, if I don't do this now, then like, what if it goes away? Like, what if I like go back to seminary and start doing the things and I'm just like, oh, well, I forget about it or whatever. And he's like, he had this really wise phrase. He's like, if this is a real call from the Lord, you won't be able to forget about it. And I was like, oh, fair point. So I really like, and I think this is one of the like things that I want to encourage people in general when they discern to do is I went back to seminary that spring with an attitude of, I think I may be called to leave, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to put myself back into the seminary community and live this as well as I can, like even better than I had before. Like, not that I hadn't been living it well, but I think, you know, we all slack off at times, but I'm going to try to be the best seminarian I can be. And if I still feel this call toward marriage and toward like leaving seminary, like it felt like the Lord was calling me to leave seminary. Right. If I still have this clear sense in prayer that I should leave at the end of the spring semester, then I will. And long story short, that happened. the semester went really well. Like, it was actually like it was probably one of the best semesters I had in seminary. And yet I still felt this very clear sense. And the way that I've described it to a lot of people was it was a sense of freedom, but it was also a sense of I don't want to say fear, because fear is often has a bad connotation, but trust maybe is a better word to use. That a friend of mine described something that I loved the way they described it, of there were kind of two paths ahead of me. On the one path, there was this road ahead of me that I could see of I was about to start my fifth year of formation, which would have been going on a pastoral year for a year. And then I would have had one more year at the seminary, then ordained a deacon, then one more year, and I'd be a priest. And so I had this clear path ahead of me that if I stay on this path, I do this, then I'm ordained a deacon, then I'm ordained a priest, then I like go live as a priest in the Archdiocese of Baltimore. Very clear road ahead. On the other path, there's darkness in the sense of like the unknown,
right?
But there's Jesus there, and he's asking me to follow him and trust him. And so I had to kind of take this, what I consider very much like a leap of faith, and just be like, all right, Lord, I am pretty certain this is where you're calling me to go, and I wish I knew what the future held, but I don't. And so I'm just going to trust you and do that. And so I left seminary in May of 2022 at the end of the semester, and yeah, I mean, it's been a crazy but good journey since then.
Honestly, I think this is like almost a master class on discernment. It's practical, it's simple, but it's very informative. So I'm learning a lot just by talking to you about this. And I know you've shared this story with me before, but just the whole process by which you went about it is so noble. It is difficult, because we do sometimes, we feel we hear in that locus, we hear God, and we're like, okay, got to act this second. So it's like we ask God to help us discern, mm-hmm. and we expect an answer immediately, which isn't good. But sometimes when we get an answer, we think, okay, I need to act immediately.
Yeah, exactly.
And no, that's not necessarily the case. And in many situations, it seems like it's rarely the case, unless it's an obviously glaring situation where you need to get out of whatever you're doing. But
sure, yeah.
Yeah, I love that message, or that that maxim from one of the priests to one of your professors or whatever, who said, "If God wants you to do it, you're not gonna forget about it."
Yeah,
and just give your all to what you're doing at the moment, and that will make things more clear. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I'm definitely gonna apply that to my life.
Yeah.
So, you left seminary, and how have things been since?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I'll share from that is the last almost 2 years now at this point has been a really good journey of continued growth and discernment in the ways of how to live. I've been, you know, learning how to date, learning how to work in it, because really, like, I did an internship when I was in college, but actually I never actually like really worked like in a 9-to-5 type capacity, because I went straight from college into Focus, which was work, but it was a very particular type of work, and then into seminary. And so the last 2 years have been an interesting adventure of learning how to work in a 9-to-5 job as a tax accountant now for the past almost 2 years. And learning how to date. And right now, like, by the grace of God, I have a really wonderful girlfriend who we just celebrated recently 6 months together. So, awesome. And that's been going very well. But I think the biggest life lesson that I've learned with my, especially with the last like 6 months with my spiritual director, has been realizing that the one tendency that I still had even when I left seminary is I've always had kind of a, this is part of my nature, I think I've always had kind of a full forward or stop tendency with my like way of life or whatever, of like I'm either going to do everything all in all at once or just like not do anything. And that thing, like what you were just describing about the patience thing, kind of I view that as partially patience, what you were just recognizing in that. That's something I've been growing in a lot more recently, is realizing that I don't need to figure everything out right now. And I don't need to plunge myself into everything right now either. That like I can kind of slowly progress through life. So like I just, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast. I just moved, whatever it is, 4 months ago now. And even with that, like I've done better, I think, at kind of allowing myself to settle in than in the past. I think I would have tried to get involved in like everything I could at the local parish and like try to make as many friends as I can and build up as much of a community as I can. And like, those are good things. It's not that they're not good, but you don't need to do all of them all at once. Like, we can take time over things and actually like slowly process through things and slowly discern things and slowly figure out like, where am I being called? What should I do right now? And even like, I don't think it's a big deal to share this because I'm not taking any action on it right now, but you know, in my current job, like when I first got into this job, I kind of didn't like it in certain ways because of some of the work I was doing and stuff. And I was like, man, like I want to, you know, spend like a year or two in this job and go to another job. And I've like realized more and more recently that I'm like, I don't need to rush that. I can take time over this and just be in the place that I'm in the job that I'm at, and work that job virtuously and well. And if at some point down the road I get a sense that I should go do something else, then I will. But like right now, I don't have a clear sense that I should be going to some other job. And so there's no reason for me to be like concerned about that. I can just let myself be in the place and in the job that I'm in for right now. And that can be stressful at times, but it also can be good at times. And not have to try to figure out everything of the future all at once.
That's a beautiful way to approach it. Something we can all learn from, definitely. It's easy to be consumed by the future and not live in the moment. And what does that actually look like? It's difficult to discern sometimes. But it's also just being okay with frustrating experiences.
Yeah.
And I can say, Peter, that you've had a big impact on me. You started a men's Bible study 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Even though I have not been in attendance as of much lately since the move and since I've just been busy with work.
Yeah.
But through that Bible study, I've gotten to know the men's group that I'm a part of now.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been fruitful for me spiritually. And another men's group that I've joined because of that. It's been an absolute gift getting to know you. You've been instrumental in my spiritual growth. And you're an awesome guy. And you've been through a lot. My goodness.
Thanks.
Looking at your life, you've overcome, you know, losing your vision and struggling through things during your childhood, and then going on to your brother unexpectedly out of nowhere passing. And what you've turned into is something truly beautiful. And I think that's something we forget all the time, is that in order to become stunning, in order to become excellent, we have to overcome certain trials in life. And we can look at them as burdens and as roadblocks, but they're not really roadblocks. They can be roadblocks, but they also could be steps.
Yeah, yeah, that's
true.
That
we just have to climb. And when we do that, we get higher up. And you're definitely someone who has chosen to climb. And I find that incredibly admirable. So
yeah, which I think the last thing I want to share from my standpoint with all of what you just said is just to clarify or to kind of encourage people that, and by no means am I trying to say that like this whole conversation has built me up to look like a saint or something, but just to be clear that like I still struggle in tons of different ways. I still sin. One of the things that I've realized too over the years, because when I first encountered praying with my vision loss and all that, I thought naively, I thought that was like a one-time thing that I do this. And then like, I got that great locution from the Lord and like the Lord loves me. All right, I'm good to go now. And like, I have realized in recent years that it is a constant life thing that like, I have to keep praying throughout my life with the challenges of my vision, the challenges of how I live, of just like encountering life on a daily, that whole thing of trying to take things a day at a time, like that's a daily struggle. Like, so just to be clear to everyone that it's not, you know, it's not like I'm just like, oh, I'm just like living my best self and I'm just all good now. Like, no, like there's, it's like constantly difficult, but it's just that I continue to pray and trust in the Lord. And that is one of the like biggest benefits, I guess, to share too from my time in seminary is I grew to have a really great love for the divine office, the liturgy of the hours that priests and monks and sisters pray on a regular basis. And Vatican II actually encouraged all of the laity to pray it whenever possible. And so I still do the office of readings and morning prayer every day from that, and try to do night prayer and when I can, sometimes evening prayer. And that's been a really beautiful way for me to stay like connected on a daily basis with the Lord, because you're praying with the Psalms, with readings from Scripture. And so that just, it's just such an anchor that like, I think the important thing is to always be continuing to pray and trust in the Lord. Like Padre Pio said, like pray, hope, and don't worry.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah, that was great. That was great. Just trying to think of a right way to wrap it up. Thank you, Peter, for being so vulnerable, being willing to talk about things. It's not always easy to let's unpack the past, because the past is also great, you know?
Yeah.
But I think what you did a great job of articulating is, and you said you're still dealing with, is that you're not perfect now. It's not like you've made it. You and I were still pretty young guys. And the best way probably to characterize our relationship with God is a struggle. I mean, that's what Israel means, to struggle with God. Mm. And that is a spiritual journey. And it's tempting to kind of think, look at us, we've made it, but we haven't. If eternity is what in store for us, this is simply just the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful beginning. So thank you, Peter. That was awesome. You. We loved hearing your story. And if anyone ever has any questions, like we said, you can find us, our Gmail in the description of mountainsandmen@podcast.gmail.com. We would love to hear from you guys, even suggestions for video ideas or podcast ideas or just questions you want us to answer. Mm-hmm. So we hope all is well. And you guys take care. God bless.
God bless.